News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And, you know, it's been a nice week outside, great weather.
It's been hot.
Yeah, it's been hot,
sticky.
But actually it's been quite pleasant.
It's better than cold, right?
We were driving around Tampa the other day.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for a new location for Stratford down in Tampa. And it was kind of interesting. We had some guy, the driver had a Garmin navigation system.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other guys with us had he was using the Google Maps on Android, and somebody else was using the Apple Maps on the iPhone, and they were all set to talk. So it's like having three backseat drivers because they didn't agree with each other.
Of course not.
And then there was comments on top of that, so there were four people in the car, three talking navigation systems, two backseat drivers. It's a miracle that we actually made it.
Did anyone get punched in the process?
No, no one.
no one got kicked in the shins.
No one really did get punched, but they, but they actually didn't agree with each other, and so it created some confusion.
And of course, everybody's like, "Well, mine's right." Right.
That's exactly right. So my advice is, just go with one navigation system at a time.
I was on a bus yesterday, and somebody is looking at, and we're stuck in traffic. And so she figures out, looking at Google, that it's going to take her an hour plus to get wherever she's going. She calls somebody. She says, you never expect to hear this. Google says it's going to take me an hour and 15 minutes to get to you. What do you want me to do?
That's right. Google is now into everything.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And, you know, now this week I heard that even Google is getting involved in all of the Department of Justice efforts to gather data.
Oh, boy.
And so we'll talk a little bit of what they're going on. Today we're going to feature the man behind meetup.com.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, was the website for organizing meetings that became very popular back in 2004 when it got heavily involved in the presidential campaign.
Sure.
And they were collecting things up. And, of course, we had a huge mailbag.
How big was
it? Let me put it up on the counter.
Huge.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
It's giant. Oh, let me get this thing opened. It's
okay.
You know, I think we're going
to... You might need a pocket knife to cut into that.
I'm really thinking I'm going to have to get maybe some Tech Talk assistants in here to help me with the mailbag, because it's getting bigger and bigger every week.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Alice. Dear Tech Talk, I'm curious how Google can know my location. Is there anything I can do to keep it secret?
Ooh.
Thanks. Alice in Reston. Well, Alice, I don't know why she's trying to keep her position secret.
We have all these people with pictures and secret locations, and I don't know.
We've got some very unusual listeners. Oh, we certainly do.
Uh-huh.
Well, Google can get some idea from your external IP address that your ISP provides. So, like, if you're with Verizon in Washington, they know where the IP addresses have been assigned. And they can get a pretty good idea that it's a Washington location as opposed to a location in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
So they can do that very, very easily, actually. But it turns out they can get even more precise than that.
No kidding.
Because they had – remember when they did Google Street View?
Yep.
Well, the Street View actually had a Wi-Fi detection system on it. So as they go around, they can detect all of these different Wi-Fi nodes.
Uh-huh.
And then they can locate exactly where those Wi-Fi nodes are. And then if you're using one of these nodes that they've identified, then they have a pretty good idea where it is because Google Street Maps picked it up. And then, of course, if you are at home using your iPhone or one of these smartphone devices with your Wi-Fi system, your phone may be sharing GPS data with Google.
Yeah, sure.
So then they even have a better idea of where you are from the GPS data. So there are all sorts, they call this data leakage. There's all kinds of data leakage that gradually Google knows more and more and more mm-hmm. about you.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people don't like it, but others do because it gives Google a chance to give you better information that's specific to you. But that was a great question, Alice, and Google is watching.
Now, you can, if you were to, I suspect she's got something turned on her smartphone,
yeah, you
right?
Yeah, you could configure your smartphone so you wouldn't share that data,
yeah.
I would think. But, you know, that's, but they do that quite often. But you could certainly do it so it wouldn't share it. But, so Google, basically, any data that leaks out, they're going to get. And they're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to correlate data. See, the power of Google is that they correlate data from different sources, and it gives them an enormous amount of power. We got an email from Hawk in Bowie, another one of our regular listeners.
Yes.
Dear Doc and Jim, recently Google and Microsoft asked me to insert my telephone number. And they kept asking until I agreed to insert the number.
Wow.
What's the main reason for this? Do they have some kind of hidden purpose? What, my phone number? What's going on? I don't really want to give them to this. This is kind of a privacy issue.
Sure.
Why would they even want it? Love the show, Hawk and Bowie. Well, Hawk, actually, it's not a bad idea. Usually, I don't like give out my phone number, but what they use it for is account recovery. You see, your phone number, in particular, your cell phone number, is a piece of information that Google and Microsoft can use to restore access to your email or other account. Suppose you've forgotten your password and you're locked out, or suppose somebody hijacked your account, you can't get in. Well, you could go in and reset it and have them send you the reset information by text to your cell phone. And Google and Microsoft are pretty sure that's a good way to communicate with you because you're the only one at the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very reliable way to do it. So the cell phone number is another way to communicate with you, just as a secondary email address is another way to communicate with you. So I'll have to admit that I do provide my phone number just so I've got that secondary way of resetting my account. And I don't think they're using that for any other secretive purposes like giving it to salespeople. So I wouldn't worry about it in this case.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from a loyal listener in Bethesda. Dear Tech Talk, I'm thinking about installing Google Chrome. That is, of course, the browser
right.
that Google has released. I currently use Internet Explorer 8. Will Chrome install over my Internet Explorer and then become the default browser, leaving IE as a used program in the background? Loyal listener in Bethesda. Well, first, you can have more than one browser on your machine, Loyal. I guess I'll just call her Loy for short. Well, Loy, you can have more than one browser on your machine. Many people do. And once you install Google Chrome, you'll still have Internet Explorer available to you. Now, there will be an icon for Internet Explorer down in the programs menu, and you can click on it. It will come up at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Internet Explorer, and you'll get another. You can also drag another icon down to the tray for Chrome, and anytime you click on that Chrome browser, it will come up. Now there is a choice for the default browser. Suppose you know, like sometimes you just say want to open up an HTML document, and the computer selects which browser they use. That's the default browser, and so when you install Chrome, they'll ask you whether you'd like Chrome to be the default browser or not, and,
mm-hmm.
and you can choose which one you want to have as a default browser. Now, actually, I have five browsers on my computer. I've got Internet Explorer. Let me see if I can remember the Internet Explorer, and I have Chrome, and I have Foxfire.
I have those three.
I have Opera, and I have Safari.
What's your favorite?
I like Chrome.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. Chrome seems to run a little faster than the other ones that I have.
It does. But the reason I have five is that, you know, we've got all these Stratford websites and things that are coming up in HTML. And all the browsers are actually support the standards in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to see what the Stratford web pages look like in the whole assortment of browsers. So I'll frequently just look at all of our pages in all these multiple browsers. And most people don't have five, actually.
No,
it's
they
not,
don't.
It's actually not necessary.
No, it's not. But there are some applications. I look at a lot of cameras, like video. Mm-hmm. And each browser allows you to open up only two windows. So in order to see more cameras all at once, I have three browsers going, so I can look at six instead of two.
I see. Okay. Well, very good. So you're all set there. And Chrome is a bit faster than the other ones, and they conform to the standards quite nicely. So Chrome is actually picking up market share each year as we go. We have here we go. Oh, yeah, we have an email from Dave. Dear Tech Talk. What is DHCP? Somebody keeps talking about this in relation to their Wi-Fi router. Thanks, Dave, in Boulder. Oh, he's from Boulder Colorado. Yeah, that's nice. Well, DHCP, Dave, stands for Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. In a nutshell, DHCP is a protocol that allows your computer to make a request for a dynamic IP address, and then that same protocol is used by the DHCP server to send that IP address back to your computer.
Mm-hmm.
So let me have a small aside here.
Aside, please.
Every computer has to have an IP address. That's an internet protocol address. It's sort of like your street address. If somebody wants to find your house, you've got to have a street address, so otherwise they can't find you. So your IP address is your street address. Now, on the big worldwide internet, every IP address has to be unique because, obviously, if you have two street addresses that are identical, you don't know where to go.
Right, exactly.
So the IP address which faces the internet is complete, is always unique, and so typically, your router, if you're at home, you get that IP address from your internet service provider. So every time you turn on your router then requests a dynamic IP address from the internet service provider, and you get it in about 10 seconds. And that's used by the DHCP protocol. Now, if you've got 10 computers on your, network at home, you've got then an internal network. And each of those computers has to have an IP address, which is internal. And those internal IP addresses are not unique. They're probably repeated all over the place because the only IP address that the world sees is your external IP address. So when you turn on your computer with your Wi-Fi router, as soon as you turn it on, it says, hey, I need an IP address. And your router is set up to be a DHCP server, so it sends the IP address back to the computer, and then you've got an internal IP address. So that's really all you wanted to know. DHCP, it's very convenient. Then you don't have to sit there and actually plug in an IP address every time. Because if you had to do it manually at home, you'd have to punch in the IP address. You'd have to put in the address mask.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have to make certain you'd have a different address for each computer. It's just a lot of management. So you just let the DHCP server handle all that management, and it's all done automatically in the background. It's a very, very convenient protocol. We got an email from Benoit in New Jersey. Dear Tech Talk, my ISP just informed me that my inbox was full. Now, after much chat with the ISP, I learned that the ISP was returning not to the inbox in my Windows Live inbox, but rather to the inbox on their server. How long does an ISP keep emails on its server? I'm kind of confused about this. Thanks, Benoit. Well, Benoit, how long they keep it on their server, it really depends on their policies. Sometimes they'll keep them for a certain length of time. More than likely, they don't put a time limit on it. They put the amount of storage they'll give you limit on it. So when you run out of storage, they start telling you to delete emails. Now, when you configure your POP server, your POP client, Post Office Protocol client, this is the email client on your computer, when you first configure it, you give it the address of your internet service provider's mail servers. You put in the password, and so every time you get your email, say in Windows Live, it goes to the internet service provider and it downloads the email to your computer. Now, when you set up that email account, you have a choice. You can either have the emails deleted on the main mail server after they've been downloaded to your computer, or you can download them to your computer and just leave them on the main server. Now, what I do when I configure all my POP accounts, I just leave it on the main server. Mm-hmm. That way, I could have multiple computers accessing the same mail server, and that mail downloads to all of my computers, not just to one. That means that over time, the mail in your internet service provider's mailbox just builds up and up and up. So recently, I've got so many email accounts, but I just got a notification from Verizon. I had a Verizon account. They said your mailbox is filling up. So then I had to log on to the web interface of my mailbox and just delete a bunch of stuff and bring it down, delete stuff I didn't want anyway, and then brought it down into speed and brought it down, you know, substantial, so it was way below the memory limit, and then I was set. That was a good question. Many people don't really understand the POP server actually takes the email and downloads it to your computer. You've got the other kind of email, which is the web interface like Gmail or Yahoo Mail, where you basically log on to the server and you look and your inbox is actually, there's only one inbox. It's the inbox on the Gmail server or on the Yahoo server. And if you delete it there, it's gone. So there aren't really two servers in use, but you're basically using the web interface there for that mail server rather than the post office protocol, rather than the POP way to handle it now. But good question, yep. And we love your questions coming into Tech Talk. Send us your email questions to techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll cover them on the show. You can also check out Stratford's programs by going to stratford.edu. And don't forget, we are monitoring the Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline. And we will check your comments during the show.
And of course, it is Saturday morning, and you are listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Profiles in IT.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to be talking about Scott Hefferman. Scott Hefferman was co-founder and CEO of Meetup.com, a site for organizing local groups. Scott Hefferman was born in Homewood, Illinois in 1972. At nine, he started his first entrepreneurial lecture. He was the youngest of five kids, and when he was 9 years old, I think the next sibling might have been in his 20s. So he was actually always the baby of the families. But at nine, he founded his first business, Scott's Slave Service, where he marketed menial tasks to his siblings. Not a bad idea.
No, it's a great idea.
You know, so the kids were, you know, his brothers and sisters were supposed to come back and do work. He auctioned himself off, and he did the work for them for a little bit of money. At age 12, he programmed the Apple II computer that the family owned to manage the inventory of his parents' paint store.
Mm-hmm.
His mom died when he was only 16, so actually his older siblings and his father really raised it. So he felt like he had many, many parents, mm-hmm. not just two.
Mm-hmm.
He studied engineering at the University of Iowa, but he wasn't good in math. Now, see, an engineering major who's not good in math has a problem.
That's a problem.
He ended up getting his Bachelor of Science in Business.
Well, he seemed to be good at that.
Yeah, he's good in business.
Yeah.
He paid for his first year of college through a business that he started in high school. He sold a coupon package for a surrounding town. He went around and got, you know, he got these coupon packs. Well, he created his own pack and sold them. And he, you know, he made enough money to pay for the first year of college. While he was at college, he worked at the college radio station and hosted a weekly radio show called Advertorial Infotainment.
Okay.
Advertorial Infotainment. It was about the culture, which is increasingly being overrun with ads.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like a anti-business tone to it, which is interesting since he was selling ads, and he went into selling ads later on. But at that time, he was kind of a protesting against businesses advertising everywhere. After he graduated from college, he accepted a job with Sony in Montvale, New Jersey. Now, listen to this job title. Interactive Marketing Frontiersman.
Oh, boy.
Interactive Marketing Frontiersman. Well, I'm the local frontiersman here at Sony.
Can you hear my eyes rolling
over
there?
I mean, listen to that job title. Well, that job only lasted a year, and then he was out of there.
Uh-huh.
He moved to Queens, and in 1995, he started an online ad agency called iTraffic. Now, look at this. He was actually against advertising and advertorial infotainment. His first business, he starts an online ad agency. Come on, Scott. You sold out to the man.
He did.
You sold out to the man. It was called iTraffic. And 4 years later, in 1999, iTraffic was purchased by agency.com. And then he stayed on and worked for agency.com and managed iTraffic. But by the year 2000, he was just sick of all of the stuff that he had to deal with agency.com, and he quit. And he said he was so sick of investment bankers, he just wanted to do something completely different. So he went down and worked at the counter at McDonald's just for a couple of weeks because he said, you know, I think I need a real job. He said, I need something real where I actually do something and talk to people instead of all of this internet mumbo jumbo.
Sure.
So he connected with himself as he was, you know, serving hamburgers. Now, he lived in New York City and in the Queens. And, of course, September 11th, 2001 is when the World Trade Center was attacked. And he started thinking about the community and what he could do to help the community. It sort of changed his whole focus on life, this event. And he came up with 30 ideas that he could do for his next project. He narrowed them down to two. Now, the first idea was a company called Photolog, which it's a social network where you upload photos. And he was co-founder of Photolog. And now this is a social network that, as it turns out, is big in South America.
Huh.
You know, they kind of pick up, you know, once you get you create a social network that really took off in South America. Now, the second business that he had that he was thinking of starting was meetup.com. And this is a way for people to self-organize locally. With four others, he started meetup.com in January of 2002. So that was just a few months after September 11th, 2001. Now, people would sign up for meetup.com, and they'd indicate where they'd live, what kind of topics they're interested in. And when a certain number of like-minded people who, say, were a group of people, say, all interested in, you know, Renaissance history, mm-hmm. were all living in this particular area and close together, meetup.com would sort of say, hey, you've got similar interests, you're close together. And meetup.com would then organize a meeting and invite them all to the meeting. So the idea was to use the internet to get people off the internet in order to you know, communicate face to face.
Using the internet to keep people off the internet. That's I like right. that.
So this site gained enormous notoriety in 2004 when 190,000 of Howard Dean's supporters joined and spontaneously organized and used this social media activity to raise money. Mm-hmm. Remember, Howard Dean just blew the lid off fundraising in that particular primary until he had his...
Until he blew up.
Until he blew up and started screaming. But this was the first entree of social media to presidential politics, and it forever changed presidential politics. Mm-hmm. And Meetup.com was right in the middle of it. Meetup earns most of its revenue from a small monthly fee charged to the organizers. So if you want to organize a meeting, you've got to pay. If you want to just join and sort of go to other people's meetings, you don't have to pay. In 2008, he married Emily Krasnor. She's a human rights professional, and she wants to, you know, save the world. So in a few years, they plan to go to a developing country like Africa, and she can work on her human rights, and he would then try to expand Meetup.com globally. This is sort of his grand mission in life. Now, as of December 2011, 10 million people have registered on Meetup, and people are self-organizing over 100,000 meetings a week. Now, Meetup's investors include some of the you know, the luminaries in IT. eBay invested in it. Odemeyer Network invested in it. Draper, Fisher, Jerviston invested in it. Esther Dyson, she invested. She was the first investor, Union Square Investors and others. In 2004, MIT Technology Review named Scott the innovator of the year of those under 35. His personal blog is scott.hefferman.com. And, you know, I read this blog. It's sort of like random musings. I don't know how coherent it is, but you can sort of you can kind of get a window on his thoughts. And he's still very much anti-establishment if you read the blog. He has a Twitter account at Hef, @HEIF. I'm not following him on Twitter. I did read his blog. So there you go. Scott Hefferman, who was the co-founder and CEO of Meetup.com, he actually did graduate from college. So I think his parents and his siblings should be quite happy with him.
So Meetup changed presidential politics.
Mm-hmm.
So from that, did Twitter and Facebook follow along, or was Meetup really the first social media that changed the way we?
It was the first one that really this whole idea of organizing spontaneous support groups to support politicians, that was the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are other Meetup websites, but that was the one that showed the power of social media,
mm-hmm.
and so then that. Then they expanded that idea, because once they can spontaneously organize people, then people can have all kinds of fundraising events. They can have all sorts of, you know, bring out the grassroots vote. Then they expanded into fundraising,
mm-hmm.
so that you could, you know, get a dollar from a million people instead of $1 million from one person. And then most recently, then they moved into big data. Mm-hmm. Analyzing who's most likely to vote, who's most likely to give money. And so now they gather data, they use social media for fundraising, for spontaneous meeting generation, and big data to target the right people.
Now, President Obama has been, I guess his organization has been credited for using social media effectively in order to get him where he is. What was it? Was it Facebook? Was it Twitter?
It was big data.
It was big data.
What he did, I mean, see, both Romney and Obama used social media. So just on the straight social media, they were probably not that far off.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama used big data, and what he did, they looked at the behavior of individuals to decide who was most likely to be in favor of Obama and who would most likely need a little prodding to vote. So they targeted specific people based on big data inclinations, and that was extremely successful at bringing out a marginally few number of additional people that made the difference to the election. So now when people have gone back and looked at that election, they said big data made the difference.
So where do you think we're going to go toward the next presidential election? How is social media going to evolve in that realm?
It's still going to be used for fundraising and for meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now the Republicans are going to pick up on big data. So now all three of those are really locked in. And, I don't know of any transformational thing that's going to occur now at this point. But I think it's just going to be more of the same right now. It's there may be new sites that come up. There are now you're seeing where people are advertising on the Internet. They're trying to get their message out on the Internet. They're trying to find a way to connect to the uninformed. I mean, the problem is in America, only about 20% of the people are actually keeping track of political events. And you got the 80% that are relatively undernourished in terms of information.
Well, that's interesting. In the information age, and mm-hmm. it gets more so all the time and more rapid, that it seems like fewer people are paying attention.
Fewer people are paying attention because we have so much information,
mm-hmm.
so much flawed information,
mm-hmm.
that we basically are suffering from information overload.
So you get burned out on it.
You just get burned out. And so now I think the Internet is going to find a way to target people in a way that they'll absorb it. It's just like, you know, once these commercials come on, I mean, people just kind of tune them out.
Yeah.
So now there is a problem that people are underinformed. See, in the old days when we had newspapers, people would read kind of a thought piece. It would kind of get deep into it all. And now it's just word bites, Twitter feeds.
It's 140 words, right?
Yeah, and it's just
characters.
And, it will be some Facebook post that doesn't have a lot of information. And then people just sort of, you know, gather a lot of shallow information, which is not necessarily that accurate. So and that's why you need this big data to figure out who you should target and who's going to be most effective for you. And so the Democrats were able to target their get out the vote in the areas that were most effective, and the Republicans weren't able to do that. So Howard Dean was the man who started it all.
It's all – I mean, it seems like the next presidential election now, the search for the White House begins – right after the inauguration. Have you been looking, and do you see anybody out there who's using social media effectively now, maybe trying to position themselves for the next election?
I haven't seen anything, you know, dramatic yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we'll watch. We'll watch for that.
Very good.
Yeah.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Hope you're paying attention to that segment, because your chance to win a fabulous prize for sharing your knowledge with us is coming up in the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Tech
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
I hope you have been listening to this radio show because this is an addition to
a radio show.
It is a classroom of the airwaves.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, if we have a classroom of the airwaves, we have to have a pop quiz of the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the show, I was talking about Scott Hefferman. He's the co-founder and CEO of Meetup.com. After he sold his first company, iTraffic, where did he work? It was kind of a career change, and he worked at another location. Call in. If you get the right answer to that, you win two tickets to fine dine at the Escoffier Dining Room or at the Karem Dining Room. And it's a great five-course meal. And tell them how they can reach the studio.
Well, that would be the key to the winning the prize here is calling us on the POTS line here, which is if you're calling from west of Homewood, Illinois, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Des Moines, Iowa, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, everybody else all around the planet and the fruited plain, you can call us at 877-936-9333.
Yes, and if you're calling from Andalusia, Spain, for instance, you can use Skype, and you simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and that will be forwarded directly to the studio, and you'll talk to us free of charge.
But I would suggest it's easier to just call 877-936-9333.
It could be easier.
Could be.
Yes, it could be easier.
Have we had a Skype winner yet?
No.
No, we haven't.
We haven't.
So I would say yes, it is easier.
Yeah. Okay, the former Microsoft Windows chief defends Windows 8, sort of. The ex-Windows chief, Steven Sinofsky, is happy with the miserable sales record of tablets and PCs running his Windows 8 product.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft earlier this month claimed that it sold 100 million Windows 8 licenses. Analysts recorded a massive drop in PC shipments worldwide, and its orders were down for the first 3 months of 2013. And Windows 8 did not actually help revive the sales of PCs. It actually hurt it.
Mm-hmm.
Many blame the radical change that Microsoft made to its user interface with Metro and the removal of the Start button. Yes, and the relative expense of touch PCs. See, what they did, they made a system, they tried to make one operating system work for touch computers as well as conventional computers. And actually, if you had a regular computer, why do you want an operating system that's optimized for touch? And if you upgrade a regular computer to touch, you've got to upgrade the screen, and then it becomes more expensive. So people didn't know, is this a touch operating system or a regular operating system? And they wanted the start button back. In any case, it was a drag on sales. And so instead of a pop in sales like they usually get, they got a drop in sales. Now, Sinofsky unexpectedly left Microsoft amid much mystery just 3 weeks after the launch of Windows 8 and before the launch of the Windows Surface Pro tablet. He's now on sabbatical as executive in residence at the Harvard Business School. Think of executive in residence at Harvard Business School, where he writes about disruption and conversations in his blog, Learning by Shipping.
We have all of these fancy titles today that you're throwing about that people
know.
Have.
That's right.
Hey, we're still looking for a winner. So the number to call is 877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. And I will give you this hint. This is a place that you may have been this week, and you don't have to get out of your car when you get there.
This was after he sold iTraffic. He got so sick and tired of investment bankers that he decided to work at a particular location for a while to just feel like he had a real job.
877-936-9333.
So Intel is trying to claw their way back into the mobile marketplace. You know, the Intel has almost no penetration into the mobile marketplace at all. So if you look at what's happened, we used to have what they call the Wintel, Windows and Intel conspiracy that were really driving PC sales. Now PCs no longer are selling, and so Microsoft is, you know, in danger of becoming irrelevant. Intel, which had focused on high-end processor chips, is actually completely locked out of the mobile market, and people didn't go to the Intel chips because they weren't that power efficient. But now Intel has trying to get back in the game, and we'll see if it's too late for them or not. They released the Haswell processor. The Haswell processor, and this was a new family of core processors codenamed Haswell. The company will offer about it. If you install this chip in a laptop, it will give you about 50% more battery life than its current chipset, the Ivy Bridge chips. The Haswell chips are designed specifically for those on-the-go devices like tablets and laptops, and its main focus is on decreasing power consumption, not on getting more and more speed. The idea is that if you can get 50% more battery life in a laptop, it gets you to the all-day category. Wouldn't that be great to take your laptop to work and work all day, and you wouldn't have to charge it up till night? It's really a drag when your laptop only lasts 4 or 5 hours. You got to plug it in. You can't even take a flight across the country without your laptop running out of power. Now, not only do the Haswell processors have the ability to improve battery life without affecting performance, but this could be the first case where the processors are built with a sleeker, slimmer device in mind. So the packaging is thinner, so you can get so that they'll fit in these smaller devices. So the question is, are these factors enough? You know, a thinner device to meet the form factor of the new compact devices with more efficiency, or is Intel just too late at the game? Many are hoping that that the Haswell is going to help Intel get back into the game.
Excellent. Well, Doc, guess what? We do have somebody on the phone here. Let us go to Potomac, Maryland, and talk to Marshall, who calls us this morning. Marshall, good morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning. How are you?
We're good.
Good morning, Doc. Marshall. Early in the show, I talked about Scott Hefferman. He's the CEO of Meetup. Where did he work after he sold iTraffic to agency.com?
McDonald's.
That is correct. Correct. Two tickets to Fine Dining, the Escoffier Dining Room. Fantastic. Stay on the line and give your name and address to Andrew. We'll get tickets out to you next week.
And speaking of fancy titles, Andrew is the adjunct professor for prize distribution at Stratford University.
Yes, he is.
Yes. You are indeed this morning listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. We have more stuff for you coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
a budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Well, the TSA just got a little less interesting. The U.S. Transportation Security Agency. They have removed all of the nude view scanners at the airports.
You're such a bad boy.
You remember these scanners? You have to hold up your hands and step in there, and it gives what looks like a picture of you as a totally naked using microwaves to sort of do that detection. But people were very upset with this as a violation of privacy, and Congress mandated that all of these scanners, which were really expensive, just be dumped. And this, because it gave nude bodies and Pixar-like detail. And so they were so revealing that they had to actually look at them in private because there was an issue there. So they couldn't have the monitors out in the public. And actually, people were up in arms over this, said they'd rather be patted down than go through that. And
there's
so,
a line here, but I'm just going to stick.
I thank you so much. So they're now gone, and now they just display a very vague image of the passenger's body with a generic yellow box around anything which is like suspicious. So like I was going down to Tampa, and I went through one like this, and there was one dime in my pocket that I forgot about, and there was a big yellow box around that dime. It picked it up.
Huh.
So they are working. I think it's a much better deal, but. With the government, they had to buy two completely different scanners. So they spent twice as much money. So I guess the motto is do it wrong and do it twice.
And do it as expensively as possible.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about privacy issues. The
yes.
Justice Department has been requesting user data from Google. And the judge has been asked to force Google to provide user data without a search warrant. Now, a different court ruled this process is unconstitutional. Now, this is how they do. The Department of Justice asked a Manhattan judge to grant its petition to enforce a warrantless legal demand that was sent by the FBI to Google. The new lawsuit in Manhattan pitting the U.S. government against Google offers a rare glimpse into how prosecutors are trying to defend the process that allows federal agents to gain warrantless access to user records and how a company like Google is trying to defend it. The Justice Department's lawsuit filed April 22nd and not disclosed earlier was sparked by Google's decision to rebuff their demands. Now, this is what it's based on. This is kind of tricky. It centers on the Bureau's controversial use of national security letters, NSL. It's a secret electronic gathering technique that does not need a judge's approval, and it was recently ruled unconstitutional in an unrelated case. The use of NSL is controversial because they gag the recipient. If you receive one, it's illegal to tell anybody. And they're only supposed to be used in national security investigations, not routine criminal probes. And there's no upper limit on the amount of data that a single NSL can demand. The Inspector General's report found that the FBI made 50,000 NSL requests in 2006. 97% of those included mandatory gag orders. I think this is actually a problem.
Yeah.
And it kind of relates to the fact of how much data Google is gathering on everybody. So while the FBI authority to grant NSL demands predates the Patriot Act, it was the Patriot Act that dramatically expanded NSLs by broadening their use beyond espionage-related investigations. I think this is something that should be reviewed.
Doc, why don't we take a break
here,
we will come back in just a minute. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. More of Tech Talk Radio right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Let's go back to this big data in politics.
Mm-hmm.
The chief scientist for President Obama's re-election effort. Look at the re-election had a chief scientist. He was Riad Ghani. He helped revolutionize the use of data in politics. During the final 18 months of the Obama campaign, he joined a team of data and software experts who sifted, collated, and combined dozens of pieces of information on each registered U.S. voter, on every single voter, to discover patterns that led them to target specific people for fundraising appeals and ads. Some veterans of the campaign data squad.
Dangerous, doesn't it?
Data squad.
They have one of those at Best Buy.
Yeah, you know, I'm familiar with the mosquito squad, but this is the data squad. They're applying lessons learned from the campaign to tackle social issues, such as education and environmental stewardess. EdgeFlip, a startup that Ghani founded this January with two other campaign members, plans to turn ad hoc data analysis tools developed for Obama for America into software that can help nonprofits raise money more effectively and recruit volunteers. You can kind of see a parallel there.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get money, you want to get volunteers, use the same techniques. Ghani isn't the only one thinking along these lines. In Chicago, Ghani's hometown, the site of Obama for America headquarters, some campaign members are helping to make the city city records available for analysis in terms of utility usage, crime statistics, so developers can build apps that attempt to improve life there. Ghani, who's 35, had a long-standing interest in social issues like tutoring disadvantaged kids, but he developed his data mining savvy during 10 years as director of analytics for Accenture, his consulting company, and they provided data mining research and writing papers titled like Data Mining for Business Applications. So this was the first move into big data, and it made a huge difference. People believe that the data mining efforts that Ghani set up were the difference in the campaign. India is a likely source of the multinational cyber spying. You know, we've been blaming China a lot. But multinational cyber spying outbreaks carried out over 3 years against companies and agencies in dozens of nations has been uncovered by a Norwegian security vendor, Norman Shark, and a San Diego-based antivirus maker, ESET, which that's what I use on my laptop. The perpetrators appear to operate from India. The strongest evidence of ties to India is a pattern of buying and maintaining hostile websites, and there are lots of link toward Indian attackers in those data. Norman's investigation began after Norwegian telecom giant Telenor filed a criminal complaint for unlawful computer intrusion last March. Attackers began with phishing, where they send out, you know, requests for information, hoping that people will give it to them voluntarily, being tricked into do it. Mm-hmm. They identified and targeted specific senior Telenor managers, sending them legit-looking emails and getting them to click on viral attachments. They then probed deeper into Telenor's network, pilfering data, storing it on the internet, much the same as countless other so-called advanced persistent threats. So this is the name of advanced persistent threats. They go after the same company over and over and over again at different levels. The network of infected PCs and web servers used to send out tainted emails and infiltrate Telenor's account has also been used to run identical advanced persistent threat attacks against organizations in more than a dozen nations. ESET emphasized the evidence of the attacks attributed to the Hangover Gang. The Hangover Gang. What? I mean,
do they drink a lot?
Yeah, they must. Being orchestrated out of India is circumstantial, so they say just be mindful of that. Let's talk about a iPhone jailbreaker has been hired by Google. You know, there's kind of a thin line between the hacker and the security professional.
Sure.
Hacker today, security professional tomorrow. They kind of go back and forth. It's like a revolving door.
Uh-huh.
Famed iPhone jailbreaker, codenamed Comex.
Can't use your real name now,
Ken. Whose real name is Nicholas Allegra. I guess since he came to the good side.
Now that he's legit, right?
Yeah. He had to have his real name to be hired by Apple. He tweeted that he'll be joined by Google. He'll be treated that he'll be joining Google as an intern in the coming months. Allegra originally made a name for himself when he released the jailbreak tool dubbed Jailbreak Me.
Mm-hmm.
As its name applies, the tool enables users to easily and quickly bypass Apple's iOS security measures. Allegra's work eventually caught the attention of Apple, who decided to hire the Brown intern in August of 2011. Allegra lasted 14 months at Apple before being let go under somewhat murky circumstances in late 2012.
It's nefarious.
Yeah, maybe he slipped back to the hacker mode while he worked to the dark side while he worked for Apple. As for what Allegra will be up to in Mountain View, that's anybody's guess. It doesn't appear as though he'll be working on any Android matters. Mm-hmm. You know, I can see that's actually a good thing.
Sure.
Pictures from a stolen laptop showed up in Iran. This is interesting. Tom Del Torto, a London-based animator, had his MacBook Pro stolen and taken from his flat, and he'd installed an app on it called the Hidden App. It's a 15 app that lets you track a stolen machine the next time it connects to the internet. It sends back secretly pictures of the new owners. So he had pictures of the new owners with the kids playing with tools, pictures of their living room. And so what he did, he posted all those pictures to the internet, and he called it Dom's Laptop in Iran. And it was a Flickr account, and he just uploaded all these pictures, and it went viral. No, it was a Tumblr account. It went viral and just went everywhere and created a huge amount of problem for these folks. He never got back his laptop, but other people have done the same thing, have gotten back their laptop from the U.S. Listen, the show goes by so quickly. We love your emails, techtalk@stratford.edu. Go to techtalkonline.com to get our podcast, and always visit stratforduniversity.edu and let them know that you heard about them on Tech Talk.
If you missed any of the show or would like to hear it again, you can visit this radio station this afternoon at 2 o'clock for a replay of this show. See you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We have baseball on your radio later today. The Nats and the Braves from Atlanta once again. Game coverage starts at 6:45 here on Federal News Radio. It's going to be sunny, humid, hot today. 92 for the high right now, 78 outside our studios in Northwest at 10 AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions.